From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst between vacations and staycations. He's a reporter at NBC4 and a columnist for the Current newspaper. Tom, good to see you again. It's been a while. Well, I was on vacation for a little while, and you were on vacation all the time.
I stayed in the city. I didn't leave the city.
Well, are you over with vacation now?
I have a few more weeks.
It never seems to
end. I don't
want
Mark Seagraves in the audience to get from Channel 4 to get jealous. I don't want to say how many weeks I have. But I'm older than I deserve them.
Let's not hear anything from Seagraves in the Peanut Gallery today. Our guest today is Muriel Bowser. She is the mayor of the District of Columbia. Mayor Bowser, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Kojo. It's always good to be with you and Tom.
Well, you should know that there's going to be what seems to be a stealth opening of the Silver Spring Transit Center this weekend. At 4 a.m., buses will quietly begin to roll into the center. The facility's three levels will link Metro Bus, Montgomery Ride-On, and taxis and biking commuters to the adjacent Metro Rail station. It has been a while in coming. I know Mayor Bowser will be interested in this because she sometimes goes to Silver Spring. You know, I've seen her there, even though she doesn't want anyone to know this. But Tom Sherwood, you've been talking about the Transit Center for a while now.
Well, it's a horrendous goof by the Maryland and Montgomery County. It's a disaster. I'm just glad it didn't happen in the district.
Well, we're all glad about that. But we're also glad that it's opening. It's very important and key to the whole transportation network. It's going to help people get on the MARC train, metro, bus, ride on. And we know that we need to get more and more people out of their cars and onto public transportation.
You weren't invited to a ribbon cutting for the opening of this thing.
I wasn't.
You've had your share since you've been mayor.
Yes. Thank
I
you.
Suspect
yes.
At 4 o'clock Sunday morning, Tom Shaw would be there. We'll be hanging around the Silver Spring.
I'll give it all the attention it deserves at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Onto the District of Columbia. There is a report issued last week or this week by the Progressive Policy Institute suggesting that D.C. public schools should become charter schools to improve their lowest performing schools. It's an idea that Schools Chancellor Kaye Henderson has said that she would approve of in the past, but Mayor Gray attempting to, the former mayor of the district, attempting to pursue that plan. It was not popular politically. Has anything changed since then, you think, Tom?
Well, I think the success of charter schools is a dramatic success for the District of Columbia. It's done one of the things it's supposed to do, which is force the city to pay attention to its public schools. So it's a huge debate about how many of the schools should be charter, where they all should be charter. I think it was discussed last year in the mayor's race. And Mayor, your big plan was to say, Alice deal for all wards, saying that you got to improve the middle schools to keep them growing. But what is your thought about as you see the charter schools still growing exponentially?
Well, I think we have a lot of successes to talk about in our public schools in both sectors, in the public charter school sector and in our traditional public schools. We are known around the country for the investment that we made in robust school reforms. And I promised that we were just going to put our foot further on the gas when it came to school reforms. I've challenged our team. We have a great Chancellor of Schools, Kaye Henderson, and we were able to attract a leader in the charter community to be the Deputy Mayor for Education, Jenny Niles. And we're going to keep pushing hard on school reforms. We're going to ask the council, for example, this fall to really look at the amount of time that children are spending in seats learning and talk about how we can extend learning time for kids.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Mayor Muriel Bowser of the District of Columbia. You can join the conversation by calling 800-433-8850, sending email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of this broadcast there, or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. First, the first official question, Tom, you get it.
Good. The Pope's coming.
You bet he is.
Last year when I interviewed at the Hill Center during the January of a year ago, I talked about your growing up here. You talked about riding the Metro to Bladensburg, I think, to Mother, is it Mother Seton School?
Or? Well, I rode the Metro actually to Holy Names in Silver Spring, which no longer exists. And then the last 2 years that I was in high school, I went to Elizabeth Seton in Bladensburg.
What is your, before we talk about the logistics of the Pope's visit, what is your personal feeling about the Pope coming to
our we are very
excited. You should mention that the mayor is a Catholic.
I am.
Well, I thought I'd imply that,
but you didn't say it. We don't work with
implications.
For the
born,
truth course
raised,
over there.
Baptized, confirmed, and educated up to the 12th grade. I just left the Cardinal at Providence Hospital and some girls from Seton who were singing there. And as a Catholic, we're delighted to welcome the Holy Father, but especially delighted to welcome this Pope because I think this Pope is, and I think you was quoted as saying he's a breath of fresh air in so many ways. For our church, he's challenging us to think about things differently, and I think that's good for all American priests and bishops. As people who are concerned about our earth, he is in very real ways challenging us to think about the climate. I opened one of the news journals, one of the business journals, and there was an advertisement from the Pope about climate change. And then I opened the newspaper the following day, a full-page ad from the Pope about climate change. So I just think that he's doing a wonderful thing to challenge all of our thinking. And as a city, he also shares something very important to me in our agenda, and that's how a prosperous city like ours can end homelessness in the district. And part of his stay here will include serving homeless D.C. residents. And so I hope that is a call for all of us to think about how we can contribute to ending homelessness in D.C.
I have a serious question about the logistics for next week, so people listening will know what to do next week other than cower in their homes.
And
but,
pray.
But do you get to, I know you're part of the ceremony group that will be greeting the Pope, but do you actually get to speak to him? Will your parents maybe get a chance to see him or actually speak to him? Or?
And we're very hopeful about that. Certainly, I will represent all 660,000 of us in welcoming the Pope. He's going to be here for 3 days, and he is making several stops. And so I'm looking forward to the opportunity to represent all of us.
Let's talk about the people. On that day, this city will be well over a million people will be in town. Some people will work from home and all of that, but you know, the logistics of providing this going all around town, it's got to be substantial. How much of the police department's going to be involved with this as opposed to the neighborhood crime fighting?
Well, this is a national special security event, and since the federal government has classified events such as this as national special security events, there have been 50, and we have been host to fully half of them, 25 of them. So this city, the folks in local government, our police, our fire, our health department, our Homeland Security Department is very well practiced in working with the Secret Service, working with FEMA to put on events that don't have as much disruption as could be.
And recommending for people for traffic, we've talked before the show about Massachusetts Avenue.
Sure.
Where I drive every day, twice a day.
Well, not next week, you won't. Yeah.
But gotcha. One of the issues that's been raised, that's been media reports on Channel 4 and other stations, was whether the ambulance, the fire department, Chief Dean, is prepared that the ambulance be on the street just for the normal work they have to do next week. There's going to be many more people here. What is the plan for the public safety aspects of the fire department and ambulance service?
Well, the public safety plan is just like it has been for the previous 25 events. The special agent in charge, you know, the Secret Service is in.
The lead agency.
They're the lead agency for the Pope's security, and they will meet him when he lands and be responsible for him throughout. And so we, of course, have to put a lot of resources towards traffic, and we have asked the National Guard to assist us with that, so we have more people on the streets to help with that. But anytime we put our police and fire resources, we seek all additional support, whether be it mutual or be it added service, so that we can take care of the special event, but also take care of all of us who live, work, and play here, who we can't tell them not to have an emergency. So we have to be prepared to deploy in the neighborhoods as well.
And if I could, Kojo, one last
I was about to say, is the Pope segment over yet?
Your advice to the citizens of the city and the region next week.
Sure. So the federal government has directed its employees to telework where possible, where they have very robust telework policies and they don't provide direct services to people. And so we encourage them to do that. We want all Washingtonians and everybody commuting through our city to pay special attention to the closures and just avoid those areas. So the area around the Naval Observatory, throughout the Pope's stay, but also around the White House and the Capitol on the days that he visits the White House and the Capitol. Pack your patience, look at what you can bring, and also note the activities that are free and open to the public. And we really encourage everybody to go to the parade. See the parade down on Constitution Avenue and by the mall, and you will be able to get a glimpse of the Pope. I'm also very excited about hearing his address to the Congress and where there will be Jumbotron set up on the National Mall that morning. And that would be a good place if you're like me and like to gather with other people and hear the message. You can do it down on the mall.
And if you can't do any of that, you can go to the monastery in Brookland where there's a life-size cutout cardboard of the portrait of the Pope. You can take a picture next to him and send it to your friends and relatives and tell them, I met the Pope. Yesterday, Mayor Bowser, you announced a deal with Wizards owner Ted Leonsis for a 5,000-seat arena to be built on the St. Elizabeth's East Campus. As you said, it's a BFD, which we cannot interpret on public radio. This is a family show.
Use your imagination.
And as it is, the district will foot 90% of the cost of this project. Billionaire Wizards owner, 10%. How is that a good deal for D.C. taxpayers?
Well, it's a great deal. If you've ever been to the St. Elizabeth campus, you know that much has been promised and little delivered for the people of Ward 8. And when I became mayor on January the 2nd, I took a whole assessment of everything that we inherited. And we inherited some really good things, but we also inherited some Lulus. And one thing we inherited was a lot of promises to Ward 8 and St. Elizabeth that had few concrete plans. So we knew if we were ever going to really make a difference on that campus, and especially in the 4 years that I'm privileged to be mayor, we had to get something done, and we had to get it done soon. We really worked hard to attract the Monumental Sports and the Wizards and the Mystics to that campus, because not only will it be about basketball, it will be a sports complex that can attract other events. It will be an entertainment a complex that can attract the arts and cultural events as well. But it's going to be an anchor to that development, which promises more jobs and opportunity for the people of Ward 8.
The owner of the team, Ted Leonsis, compared it to the development that's taking place around the Verizon Center. But I'm going to read to you one sentence from an article in the Washington Post on June 23rd by Perry Stein. Nearly half of the Chinese residents in the district's Chinatown area are fighting to stay in a neighborhood now known more for upscale restaurants, the Verizon Center, and pricey condos than as a hub of Chinese culture. The big fear is that while this will be a development that will attract a lot of people to the area, the price of housing in that area is likely to skyrocket in such a way that the people who now live there will find themselves unable to live there anymore. How will you deal with that?
Well, the people who live there want the same type of investment that has happened all over the District of Columbia. When people from Ward 8 go to Chinatown, they say, why can't we have access to restaurants? When they go around Nationals Park, they say, why can't we have this type of energy in our neighborhood?
But so, the energy comes, and often they have to go. That's what happened in Chinatown.
Around St. Elizabeth is a 100-acre campus that is vacant. Okay, we have a hospital. We have other uses where we're serving homeless residents, but we have nothing for the surrounding community. And it happens that it is right across the street from a metro station. So it can be developed to be our most valuable land. And what we also have, and we hear from the people of Ward 8 all the time, they want opportunities for great quality affordable housing. They want opportunities for home ownership. And so it is a good thing to have public and private investment. And it's also a good thing to be able to get people in jobs that don't exist, that pay a good wage, that allow them to afford that type of quality of life.
And my final question on this, I must confess that as a Wizard season ticket holder, I give Mr. Leonsis half my paycheck. Mr. Leonsis is going to anticipate making a lot of money on this deal. Why couldn't he just pay for it himself?
Well, I'm sure he could have, or he could have just gone to Maryland, who would have paid for it, or he could have gone to Virginia, who would have paid for it.
That's what's happening to us, isn't it? All of these other jurisdictions are promising these things and forcing us into a position where we have to offer at least as much.
They're forcing us to win. I like to be in that position because it used to be in the District of Columbia when we were sitting at that table, we lost every time. We lost those businesses and those jobs. We lost that hopefulness, and we lost the pride in the District of Columbia. Now, I promised everybody we would have a fresh start in that regard, and we would fight every time. And we are going to be at the table at big deals, not only with Ted Leonsis, but with the advisory board, where we are putting a package in front of the council to create 1,000 good-paying jobs in the district. You know what I have my deputy mayor do? We look at companies all over this region, all up and down the East Coast, and we cold call them. And we tell them the District of Columbia is a good place to do business. So if I'm being forced to do anything, it's to win.
I think you have answered Hassan's question in Washington, D.C., but allow me to ask Hassan himself. Hassan, was your question just answered?
No.
I don't hear Hassan, but Hassan's question has to do with how many jobs will this deal bring to Ward 8? You said 1,000.
No, the 1,000 I was talking about, the advisory board, I think where we are forecasting is 700 jobs during the construction process and about 300 to 400 permanent jobs. Now, that doesn't include what's going to happen when we're able to kick off the development of the remaining 100 acres, which frankly would be stalled for years to come, but for this game-changing anchor.
Sports has been a big part of your early administration, but I want to ask what people ask me, and I will say to you most of them were white people, but they asked this question. They talked about the fear of crime. We've had a horrific summer of violence, much of it east of the Anacostia River. And what do you say to people, regardless of their race, who are concerned that the neighborhoods have high crime rates? How are they going to make that a safe place for people to go? Jack Evans, a council member from Ward 2, said, well, you know, people were afraid to go downtown, and the Verizon Center was built, and that spurred economic development. Same was true over by the convention center, less so around the baseball stadium. But what do you say to people who like the idea of this facility but are worried about the neighborhood?
Well, what I say, anytime we experience spikes in crime, we're very serious about getting ahead of it. We are working hand-to-hand with our police department. I think the chief of police is bringing a lot of energy and getting in front of and focusing on the areas where we have a concentrated problem, and we need concentrated solutions. We're also focused on not just the police issues, but the human services issues that can help our city be safer. So I'm introducing a whole agenda of initiatives called Safer Stronger, where we focus on putting more police on the streets where we need them, with overtime and other ways. We're also focused on investing in our crime lab so that the police can solve cases sooner and bring closure to families and victims of crime. But we're also moving for more jobs programs. So we have we're moving a $23 million package of investments and $7 million worth of jobs. So we're going to expand our 20 to 24-year-old program year-round so that we can identify real at-risk folks who, but for the government's intervention, would not have an opportunity for a good-paying job. job and would choose, who may choose to be involved in unproductive activity. And so that's a very important part of our program. We have, I started as mayor, a program called LEAP, which also identifies harder to employ Washingtonians, people who have a lot of barriers to employment. And we are putting them in a preparatory program for vacancies that exist in D.C. government. And I'm going to expand that with our Safer Stronger package to the Department of Public Works and the Department of Parks and Recreation.
That's D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. She is our guest this hour. Our resident analyst is Tom Sherwood. He's a reporter at NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. You can call us at 800-433-8850 with your comments and questions. Here now is Ken in Washington, D.C. Ken, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. Yesterday, I was out in front of the Wilson Building. There was over 200 people speaking out against any backroom approval of the Pepco-Exelon merger. As you know, the merger was rejected by the Public Service Commission, not in the public interest. Just trying to understand if there's any updates on what it is that your administration is going to do, either support the people or make a deal.
Ken, thank you for your call. The Public Service Commission unanimously rejected that merger. However, you should know that Maryland, Delaware, and New Jersey already approved the deal. D.C. is the last hurdle. There's talk of a settlement between your office and Exelon. Have you been having discussions with Exelon?
Well, my whole focus throughout this process has been on reliability, sustainability, and affordability. And that's why the Public Service Commission exists, to make sure that ratepayers and the people of the District of Columbia can count on the utility provider to be reliable, to focus on how we're using our resources best, and that we can have affordable access to electricity. So we're a party. The administration is a party to the proceedings at the Public Service Commission, and that's what we advanced. And I don't think that the company addressed those issues. I think that's what the Public Service Commission also laid out, that they didn't address those issues. Now, we are going to continue to make sure we put the district in the best position for the utility provider to address those issues.
Sherwood's going to pin you down on this. You know, Sherwood's going to pin you down
Please
on
do.
This.
To be clear, the Exelon and Pepco have until September 28th to file an appeal of the decision. Sources say that your administration is trying to see what you guys can propose to these companies to make the deal more consumer-friendly so that you, in fact, can support it. Is your intent that you want to support this merger deal, or that you don't want to support it?
I think that, and I've said throughout, that there is a substantial hurdle for a company to show its benefits of merging with Pepco. Now, that's not to say that I think that Pepco has been a perfect utility. And I think most Washingtonians agree with that. And that's not to say that we should not look to the future to see what it means to have Pepco as our utility provider for decades or years to come. But I do think to have, and the Public Service Commission was correct, there is a substantial hurdle to get over. Now, Kojo mentioned that the many states that have already approved this came up with settlements that they thought addressed those hurdles. We're not them. And it's always been my position that they have to have in front of us something specific to the District of Columbia that addresses my concerns.
So as you sit here today, then you have not seen a proposal that addresses your concerns? And
well, the proposal that we never reached terms before they went to the Public Service Commission.
Mary Che, the council member from Ward 3, yes, at the protest yesterday, said that Pepco lobbyists and Exelon lobbyists were, quote, slithering around the Wilson Building, trying to get a backroom deal. And that's what the caller, I think, was calling about, whether or not this is going to be flipped on its head. I've told that Betty Ann Cain, the chairman of the Public Service Commission, still doesn't feel that this can be fixed, that there's too many problems. But are lobbyists slithering around? Now, we should say Beverly Perry, who works for the mayor as a special assistant, I think, She's former head of PEPCO, but has recused herself in all of this.
Speaking on behalf of the lobbyists, I'd like you to know we object to the word slither.
Well, then call Mary Che. Would you like her cell phone number?
Yeah, she feels pretty strongly about a lot of issues related to the Public Service Commission. She has some choice words, I think, one time for the chairman of the Public Service Commission, which I also thought were out of line.
All right. Are we done with PEPCO Exelon?
So it would appear.
Well, what happens is just people know once it files an appeal and tries to change its proposal, the Public Service Commission has another 30 days. And then once it votes it down again, the companies could go to court.
They could. The mayor, the council, first of all, has no role, so they don't approve or they don't vote on anything. The administration's role is we're party, so our Department of the Environment moved a brief to the Public Service Commission for consideration. But ultimately, whether I think that they come to terms or not, the Public Service Commission has to approve or disapprove the merger, and then it would follow the legal course beyond that.
This is the politics hour. Former Mayor Tony Williams stood up in front of the business community groups, nonprofits this week to support the merger. Has he tried to lobby you directly, personally?
I don't think I've talked to Tony about this directly, but I always have an open line to a former mayor of the District of Columbia who endorsed me, who is brilliant, and who also has been in the seat that I'm in, having to speak for the people of the District of Columbia.
Do you have an open line to the former mayor, Vince Gray?
Yes, he can call me. Absolutely.
That doesn't mean you have to, guys. A member of our audience here would like to know, is the mayor's office doing anything to attract the TV film industry to Washington, D.C., like Baltimore getting Game of Thrones?
Well, yes, actually. One of the things that I did is I have recreated our Office of Motion Pictures, and I've combined it with our Office of Cable Television and also expanded their scope so they're focused on all manner of entertainment. We have a lot to offer in this city in terms of, just our picturesque views of the Capitol and the White House and the National Mall and the rivers. We also have really talented people who live here, and we have ability to create industry around the production of all of these venues. So we have just thought of how we're going to go after entertainment, including television and film, including our new director has focused on actually implementing the film tax credits. People will have different views about how they work, but we want to go at this with new vigor.
Well, if we keep putting up so many barriers and security barriers in town, there won't be anything to shoot.
Well, you're talking to the choir when you say that. As a person who's grown up in this town, sometimes it makes my heart sick to see how we have barricaded a lot of our national gems.
Capitol Hill police wouldn't let children slide on Capitol Hill, and they decided to do it anyway.
As they allow lobbyists to slither in the... But I wanted to go to Michael in Arlington, Virginia first. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kodler. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask the mayor about what her ideal plans would be for redevelopment of the area of RFK Stadium, and more specifically, if she was trying to attract the Redskins back to D.C. with a new stadium deal.
Well, I it's no secret, and because I've said it for years and years, and even now when people ask me, I say that I think that the ideal location for a football stadium, would be at RFK. Now, I do not think that nobody should think that I would support a stadium being constructed there with a sea of parking around it. We have many acres of very attractive real estate there. And I would challenge any development that included a football stadium to be a great mixed-use urban development that included community amenities and included other types of development that neighbors want.
Because when you were growing up, there used to be a football stadium.
There was a football stadium. It's still there, but in 2019,
there's no football.
It's going to, not only is it no football, but it's on its way to being vacant. And the last thing that you want as mayor is to have all that sea of parking and concrete and a vacant football stadium. And so what I am poised to do is that no matter what happens, we're going to have a plan for that parcel starting in 2019 so that we don't have forever and ever and ever a vacant football stadium.
I should say that there is football being played by DC United.
That's right.
Yes, for now. There's 190 acres at that site.
Yes, it's
and
huge.
And it's designated for sports or similar kinds of activities.
Currently.
We've had this conversation, and no one has said the name of the team.
The Skins?
Skins. All right, potato skins.
The Burgundy and Gold?
What is this that you've expressed your interest in having the team build its own stadium, but within the kind of development you just described, but what is the status? The team says they don't want to change the name. As soon as Dan Snyder said, I will never, 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 never change the name, that's when I first thought he might, because he just sounded panicky over it. But what is the status of any discussion you're having that you can tell us? And is the name a deal killer?
Well, this is my point of view. I'm going to control the things that I can control. And my responsibility to the residents of the District of Columbia is that we not have a vacant football stadium there in 2019 with no plan. So my approach to this is to, in 2019, be able to move a plan that's going to be best for our city.
And people who are interested in having a say in this, the DC Events, which is the organization that controls the athletic lands in town, is having a meeting on September 30th at the Washington Convention Center where people can share their views. There was a meeting last night, and 150 people, and virtually to a person, they said they don't really want a big football operation there. They want things that other people want. They want parkland. They want retail development, housing, all those things.
You can do it
all in 190 acres?
Well, we actually have more than 190 acres because adjacent to RFK is another parcel of land that we own.
The D.C. General Jail area.
And we are trying to develop that as well. And we have already made an initial partnership with a developer to get that going. So I think with RFK and the adjacent parcels that we own, we can have sports, we can have entertainment, we can have housing, we can have grocery, we can have retail. And what I hear from a lot of residents who live around that area who may not have lived around there when the football team was playing is that they want play space, and we can have that too. But we won't have one single use for all of that space.
Our guest is Muriel Bowser, mayor of the District of Columbia. You can call us at 800-433-8850. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation. Watch the live video stream. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter at NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers.
Let's wrap up the sports segment, talk about the soccer stadium in Southwest Washington.
Yes.
A lot of the deal has been done, but as I understand it, there's a September 30th deadline for the city to acquire from the Ackridge Development Corporation two of the key acres that are needed. Is there any progress? Is that going to be are you going to reach an agreement, or do you have to do eminent domain?
I don't think we're going to reach an agreement, although we have a very competitive offer on the table to Ackridge, and they can accept it. And we would like them to. But as you know, we have the authorization from the council to pursue eminent domain, where a court in short order would decide the price for the parcel, and we'll pay that price. We will get a quick title upon filing eminent domain.
And so it will not delay the construction of the soccer stadium, if you have to go to court.
Always planned for this possibility.
Got an email from George who writes, a very large number of certified business enterprises are being impacted by the large number of waivers that are being requested by contracting officers at the Office of Contracting and Procurement. The reason given most often is that these local companies do not have the capacity or capability to perform the work relating to these contracts. The basis for that reason is unsubstantiated Please ask Mayor Bowser if she's willing to impose a penalty or terminate the employment for those department heads and or contracting officers who repeatedly fail to comply with the law. Also, if she's willing to have an ombudsman in the Office of Contracting and Procurement to review these waivers in a timely manner so that the time needed to challenge the justification of waiver does not expire.
Well, I think there's a reason to be concerned that the district isn't doing enough business with our small and local businesses. I also think it's a reason to be concerned that the process hasn't always been transparent. And we have spent the last 8 months really trying to make some changes there so that we have more transparency. So I am bullish about this government working with small and local businesses. Small and local businesses hire DC residents, put folks to work, and circulate dollars through the economy.
What they are concerned about is enforcement of these regulations. When these things do not happen, it seems that nobody's punished for it, and so it happens in administration after administration.
Well, the writer should be encouraged that I'm big on accountability, and I'm big on accountability in the procurement process. I, for example, created a board called the Procurement Accountability Board, Review Board, which is executive, which I chair with the chief procurement officer, and where any procurement abnormality present themselves. I call the directors in to explain. And there are repercussions. So an employee who doesn't follow the rules willfully will not work for us anymore. These are very important issues. We will also, for the first time, I believe, be able to know exactly how much each department should spend. Our goal is 50%. And we would know the part of their budgets that is expendable for small and local businesses, and we will be able to hold them accountable to reaching those goals. You know about the failure to plan, and this is what I have found is the biggest problem in procurement. Our departments fail to plan for the whole year what they have to buy. They fail to plan for that. No wonder they can't hit their goals. So our year starts on October the 1st, and we have put a real focus on seeing what the buy is for the whole year from each of the departments so that we know and we can follow their spending with CBEs.
Hear that, George?
Well, let's follow that subject up with I've talked on this program a lot about the Department of Employment Services. It spends millions upon millions upon millions of dollars every year for contractors to provide job training, and there never seems to be any accountability of that people, A, in fact, get jobs or train for the jobs. Did they get jobs, or do they get jobs that last longer than 6 months? Does not the Department of Employment Services need a Michelle Reed type revolution to make it be more responsible?
Well, there are and this has been a bugaboo for me as well. I've told everybody we spent $100 million in workforce training that we're not convinced is leading to good paying jobs. And so it's taking longer than I thought, quite frankly, to get underneath what the root cause problems are. But we're working on them. And part of that is I think that we need to scrub the vendors who are working with us so that they know that they're not just accountable for effort.
Right.
They're accountable for putting people in jobs. And I have to always connect. I tell people all the time that part of what we do when I talk about the Wizards or Advisory Board or what we'll be able to do at Walter Reed or McMillan and putting together economic development, that's how we create jobs in the city, and that's how we have the economic engine. So when Employment Services finds somebody who needs a pathway to good quality of life in the district, that there are jobs for them that exist.
Right.
And so part of our issue
most is jobs, I might tell you, are all the security guards at the front door when you try to get in that building. It's like you're going over the Berlin Wall.
Well, not exactly.
Not quite.
What we have in this city created jobs. And oftentimes they are jobs for high-skilled workers. And we need to make sure that we're focused in our economy about how we're building more hospitality jobs, health jobs, jobs at our universities, jobs jobs along all the whole skill spectrum while we're working on building skills for D.C. residents. So, yes, Employment Services has its part of the puzzle, but we all have to focus on making sure that we're keeping the economic engine in the city going, so we're creating jobs, not just for high-skilled workers, but for all workers.
A member of our studio audience who identifies himself as Jim in Ward 2 asks, any progress on increasing D.C. tuition assistance grants?
Yeah, I went to a parade recently, and the first time I ever heard about increasing D.C. tuition grants was at that parade. I am a huge supporter, and I think it's done wonders for our entire system that we have access to these federal dollars that allow our students to pay in-state tuition, the difference between in-state tuition with grants up to $10,000. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I also think it's important, though, to realize that that funding comes from the federal government. And every time I go up on the Hill, I'm trying to shore up the program. I'm trying to say the Congress, the president proposed $40 million the last 2 years. The Congress cut it back to $30 million.
What kind of parade is there where people discuss tuition assistance grants?
Pretty
I have
boring.
Never been to one of those parades.
I have. Here you is, were there, Tom.
That's true.
Here
that's
is true. Eric, who is on Capitol Hill in Washington. Eric, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Coach. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you, Mayor Bowser.
Thank you.
So my question is, I was walking distance from the 8th Street corridor, and for a little over a year, I believe now, I've been watching this 8th Street streetcar in testing mode. And after a few months, I thought, oh, good, they're being very diligent in their testing. But I'm not sure if diligence expires, but they've been tested for a long time. And I'm wondering what the future of that is, and if there's a point coming up maybe where they'll just pull the plug on it and stop spending money doing testing if it's not working out. Thank you.
We will get the streetcar running on 8th Street.
Do you have any idea when?
Yes.
Would you care to share that with us?
No.
Soon.
Do you have a date in mind?
Will you ride it in your first term?
I will ride it in the first year.
In that case.
Can we ask another riding question out of this?
Yeah.
Metro.
Yeah.
You've appointed people to the Metro Board.
Yes.
You've agreed with Governor McAuliffe of Virginia, Larry Hogan of Maryland.
Or they with me.
Or they with you. You've been, I don't mean to put you last, very aggressive, saying Metro needs some kind of blow. Are you going to have a general manager who's going to try to right the Metro ship by the end of the year? That's what McAuliffe has said. He would like to see that person in place by the end of this year.
I think I would like to see that person in place just as soon as possible. It has been important to me, however, that the board seek a broad range of expertise when it comes to being the general manager at Metro. I specifically was interested in making sure that they considered somebody with significant financial turnaround experience. They opened up the process to include people with that kind of experience, so I'm hopeful that they will get somebody on board.
We don't need a train conductor. We need somebody who knows how the trains work and how the finances work.
Well, I think you need a leadership team that has all of those skills, but certainly getting a hold of that bureaucracy is just as important as having somebody in leadership who knows operations but also knows construction. A big part of the Metro has a huge capital spend to make over the coming years, and getting that right is very important.
$16 billion.
Yes.
Earlier this week, you asked the D.C. Council for a supplemental budget of $23 million. The budget includes $5.4 million to outfit 2,800 officers with body cameras, but there's still a great deal of debate over public access to that footage. Last week, you submitted proposed legislation for exemptions to what the public can request. This was apparently a shift from a proposal you made last month. What would be the circumstances under which police officials could withhold footage from a Freedom of Information Act request?
So my position has always been this, Kojo, that we want accountability. So we want to know as the public what our officers are doing. And guess what? Our officers want the same thing. They want to be able to have these body cameras so that they can demonstrate that they are policing in ways that are in accordance to the law and our values, too. So everybody pretty much agrees that we want body cameras. But it's also true that when people call the police into their homes, they are could be experiencing the worst day of their life. They could have a fight. They could have the mother and the father or whomever visiting could have a fight. They could, you name it. When police are called to very stressful scenes, and I personally don't want any Washingtonian to be scared to call the police because they're going to see that interaction on the evening news.
But the proposal you submitted now is not just about indoors. It's also about when members of the public view footage of their own interactions with the police, if they file a complaint, if an officer files charges against an individual over their actions. Why those?
I'm not sure what you're referring to. What we have said is that in a private setting where there is an expectation of privacy, those interactions with the police would be exempt from FOIA. However, all involved parties can get access to that footage. Similarly, we have said out in the public that there is no expectation of privacy, and there are some instances, for example, where we would exempt. I'm not going to remember all of them off the top. Out in public. But if you are an involved party, if you are interacting with the police, if you saw somebody interacting with the police, if you're involved in the situation, you would have access to that footage. Others would be able to access the footage provided that they provide a date, time, and incident. What we don't want is for there to be kind of fishing expeditions that would be a tremendous burden to the government, so much so that it would make it...
What kind of fishing expeditions are you referring to?
I get FOIA'd for the air I breathe. Seriously. I mean, there could be any kind of FOIAs. And we want people to have access to information that is useful.
Allow Mr. FOIA to interrupt.
No, but allow me to finish. And so we want to make sure that we are providing access to materials when people provide us with that information. So it's not overly burdensome to the point where we wouldn't be able to afford to do it.
But if we don't have reasonably easy access to the cameras, then what good is to having the footage? Then it just becomes evidence in a court case. But, Mark Seagraves and I from Channel 4, we asked for the tryout footage that the officers did to go forward, and we couldn't even get that footage. It just seems that we're going to have... I understand if you burst in someone's home with a domestic
violence. What did
you
request it for just a day or
the
for
chief did her first six
a month
months?
Or for the year?
Well, we wanted to see it. We weren't sure how many
What did
were.
You want to see?
We want to see the video.
Okay.
So
that's my point. So we have to be able to know, and we can't, and we would have to redact all that footage.
Why not just post footage unless you have a reason not to?
I think that we could do and that's why we have expanded the notion of public and private. We would anything that happens in public, we would release with very little redaction. So anybody caught on the camera would be exposed to the FOIA.
I have to tell you
that there is breaking news. An appeals court has struck down as unconstitutional some parts of D.C.'s gun laws. That's what's being reported by ABC News. The ruling by the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals says the city cannot require gun owners to re-register guns only 3 years after, I guess, registering them, among other things. I know, obviously, this ruling is a surprise to you, but this is radio. We want an instant response.
Well, we're not surprised. Our gun laws have been under attack for many years. We obviously disagree. We think that the Council of the District of Columbia is in the best decision to pass laws with reasonable restrictions about gun regulation in the District of Columbia, and that's where we believed that we landed. So that's just talking about that's talking about legal gun ownership. We've had a focus on illegal gun possession in the District of Columbia, which we have, and we will continue to look for ways to get illegal guns off the street.
I think the city law is very similar. Is it to the Maryland and New York laws? It's very similar, but I don't get off on that. We have another issue coming up, government shutdown. 2 years ago, Mayor Gray at the time dramatically said, we're not shutting down. We're going to spend our local funds, not federal dollars, and we're going to stay open. Every employee is essential. I believe Congresswoman Norton has it now in the federal law that the city can remain open if it uses its own reserve money. Are you up to speed on this?
Yes.
Because of September 30th, we may have another government shutdown over the Planned Parenthood issue.
Right. We will not shut down. Unfortunately, it's an issue that is an annual issue that we revisit and is part of my discussions with the members of Congress. None of them want to see the district shut down either. And I'm hopeful that they don't want our federal government to shut down. And so we call upon all the members to be reasonable and to focus on the job of this nation and keep the government open.
It's an economic blow to the city for the hundreds of thousands of people who don't come to work and don't spend money, don't eat in the restaurants, don't come for conferences.
Right. And that's certainly my concern is a parochial view. But I just think as an American who doesn't get a vote up there, I'm especially annoyed by the fact that the people who do have the privilege of representing their constituencies would not seek to come to decisions.
Speaking of national politics, where are you on the presidential campaign? And who you're supporting for president? And have you watched the GOP debate?
You might as well ask,
are you running?
No, this is a politics hour. Well, it seems longer sometimes with Kojo. But go ahead.
Yeah, so we want to make sure we have a Democrat in the White House, and that will be my focus over the next year.
You're not on Hillary.
But I love Hillary Clinton. I think she's incredibly well prepared.
Joe Biden.
I love Joe Biden.
Bernie Sanders.
He's been
Martin O'Malley.
I love Martin O'Malley. I think he's a great Democrat. But what's important is that the Democrat who would want to be the president for Washington D.C. should understand what we need. What we need here. So how can you embrace us having statehood and a vote? But there are other ways, as I have said for the past 8 months, that the president can be helpful, and that's looking at the big federal budget. We are going to ask President Obama, for example, to invest in helping us in homelessness. The president can help us with federal lands. The president can help us when we're talking about affordable housing and investing in the 8,000 public housing units that we have in the District of Columbia. I have a long list for the president.
We're just about almost out of time, but I must say, but both you and Tom are dressed pretty spiffily today. I knew that's because I would be here, but did we make you sweat at all?
I love coming here. You have tough questions, and I like to answer them.
We haven't made you sweat. We haven't done our job.
I'll come back.
Are you going to go to Trump's hotel opening when he opens it?
That hotel is important for Washington, D.C. It's on our Main Street. Mm-hmm. And we want the Trump Corporation, as Ivanka Trump, who I deal with for any issues that we have with the hotel, we want them to work with our businesses, and we want them to be a good company. Trump should stop making outrageous statements.
Thank you so much for joining us, Muriel Bowser.
Thank you. Thank you, Kojo.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter at NBC4. And thank you all for listening and for being here. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.